All right, so we're going to be in John chapter 2 tonight on our continuing study in the book of John. And what is essentially happening is John, in John chapter 1, he's gone all the way back to the beginning. He's gone to a place that the other gospel writers did not go. He went to before any of the creation. He went to eternity past, where Jesus, the eternal Word, has been always with the Father, existing in His glory. He went in John chapter 1, verse 14. We saw that Jesus then became flesh, dwelt among us, and he began his ministry. So in John chapter 1, he started his ministry. He got baptized by John the Baptist. He is now going out and he's preaching the good news that is coming from his death and his resurrection. So as we go into chapter 2, John takes us to his place that the other gospel writers do not take us to. John takes us to Jesus' first recorded miracle. So this is the first one that he ever did. And Tom, if you want to put up the map, it's not on the... Yeah, there you go. All right, so this is where Jesus is. He's up in... if you guys see that, when you see the big Capernaum that's in red, right underneath that, there's that Cana up in Galilee. That's where Jesus is. And he actually does most of his ministry in that Galilee region. If you look all the way down to Jerusalem, that's where... Most people would probably expect Jesus to be, because that's where the temple is, but that's not where he is. He spends most of his time up in Galilee, and you see his hometown of Nazareth right there. And Galilee is kind of a crappy section of the world. It just is. It still sucks to this day. It's a lot of rebels, a lot of ghettos, a lot of not very cool places. Now it's become more of a tourist attraction, because every single square inch of that place, I guess, is this is where Jesus spat once, and this is where he talked to a bird once, and all these other stuff that never happened in the Gospels. Anyway, so he spent most of his time in that area of Galilee. In this chapter, we're going to read about him going down to Jerusalem, which he does a couple times because he's a faithful Jew. And the Jewish males had to go down to Jerusalem to keep the feast days. But let's begin. In John chapter 2, verse 1, it says, "On the third day, there was a wedding in Cana of Galilee, and the mother of Jesus was there. Now both Jesus and his disciples were invited to the wedding. And when they ran out of wine, the mother of Jesus said to him, 'They have no wine.'" This is the first thing I think is really cool about Jesus. A lot of people, again, we need to get out of our minds the false versions of Jesus that church usually puts on us as we spend our lifetime in the church of looking at Jesus as kind of a bummer. Jesus is at a party. You know, he was a fun guy to be around, and I like to think about that. That Jesus says that he was anointed with the oil of gladness more than his fellow companions. Jesus was actually a fun person to hang out with. I know it's kind of surprising. Because a lot of us, because we have these false views from church of the over-the-top organ music and things like that, and we think about holy people as being the people who would never be caught dead in a party or actually having fun in it. They usually go to parties to judge people who are at the parties. But here Jesus is at the party, and he's actually having a good time, and he's about to make the party even cooler in a second here. So it says they ran out of wine. He's chilling there, and his mom's there, and they ran out of wine, which is a major faux pas in that culture. You always keep the wine flowing in that culture. The Jews were heavy into their wine. In fact, they looked at wine as a sign of joy. There's a whole, I don't have time to get into it tonight, but there's a whole list of offerings in the Old Testament called joy offerings, which had to do with pouring wine on your offering. So the Jews always looked at wine as a sense of joy. And when we're talking about a wedding, we're not talking about a wedding that lasts 2 hours. We're talking about a wedding that lasts days. The Jews like to party. And they're partying, and they run out of wine at some point in this celebration. So in verse three, his mom says they have no wine. In verse four, Jesus responds, and he says to her, "Woman, what does your concern have to do with me? My hour has not yet come." So immediately, because like we read that from our white Caucasian perspective, and we're like, oh my gosh, like that's like the worst thing. Like, I would never say that to my mom. Like, I can imagine if my mom came up, "Hey, Peter, can you help me with this?" "Woman, what does that have to do with me?" You know, like, what does that have to do with me? But in the Aramaic and in the Greek, that word "woman" is not as harsh as it is in our language. It's not like a cutting term. It's actually a term of respect. It would be kind of like if I said "madam," I guess you can kind of, that's kind of like a similar term. It's a very broad term, but it could mean a term of respect, and that's kind of how Jesus is addressing her. He's addressing her as like kind of madam or woman, like a term of endearment a little bit. But he doesn't call her mom. I think this is important. In this one sentence, he says, "Woman, what is this? What does your concern have to do with me?" And he says, "My hour has not yet come." We have to remember that Jesus spent 30 years being a normal guy. He spent 30 years, unfortunately, the Gnostic Gospels have Jesus as a little kid turning clay pigeons into birds and turning his friends into sheep, and then as a practical joke. It's not true. That's not in any of the Gospels. Jesus spent his childhood and his adulthood as a normal guy. He was a carpenter. He had a normal blue-collar job. He hung out with his family. And you have to think about the pressure that's on Mary as the mother of Jesus. Could you imagine this? If your 30-year-old son, who you've known your entire life, is just being a normal guy, all of a sudden he gets baptized, the Holy Spirit flies on him like a dove, and God the Father parts the heavens and talks to him, you're like, whoa, that's kind of hardcore, you know? And granted, she was given heads up by an angel, and the fact that it was a virgin birth, that this was going to happen. But after 30 years, isn't it funny, no matter how miraculous a thing is, isn't it funny how quickly we forget, right? You know, here's this woman has 30 years to forget the miraculous things that have happened to her. And so we do see in Jesus' ministry that she struggles with the fact that he is the Messiah. And so in this one sentence, he acknowledges that, hey, I respect you. He respected Mary. But you have to remember, I'm someone else's son. And my life is about doing his will now. My life is about glorifying God the Father. That's what it's about. So he's kind of reminding her in a way of what he's supposed to be doing. But in verse 5... we don't know if he was gesturing or something like that, but some way of how he said that insinuated to Mary that he was actually going to help him out. So in verse 5, his mother said to the servants, whatever he says to you, do it. So she does know that he has miraculous capabilities. Verse 6, now there were set there 6 water pots of stone according to the manner of purification of the Jews, containing 20 or 30 gallons apiece. Jesus said to them, fill the water pots with water. And they filled them up to the brim. So these are really big tanks that people used. And if you were here last week, we talked about baptism and how baptism was actually very big with the Jews. They baptized all the time. And this is one of the things. They had these baptismal pots that you would use to wash yourself before you went into the wedding. It was a purification kind of thing. These things were huge. And also, if we think about that, that's kind of gross. That means that people were using those things to wash off. And Jesus has them fill it with water, and he's about to... do something to the water that people are going to drink. And he says, fill them with water, and they filled them up to the brim. Verse 8, he said to them, draw some out now and take it to the master of feast. And they took it. And when the master of feast had tasted the water that was made into wine, he did not know where it came from, thankfully. But the servants who had drawn the water knew. The master of the feast called the bridegroom, and he said to him, every man at the beginning sets out the good wine. And when the guests have well drunk, then the inferior. You have kept the good wine until now. This beginning of signs of Jesus did in Cana of Galilee, and manifested his glory, and his disciples believed in him. After this, he went down to Capernaum, he and his mother, and his brothers, and his disciples, and they did not stay there many days. So, in Jesus' first miracle, this is the first thing that he chose to do to show his glory. Very interesting miracle. If you think about it, he turned water into wine at a party, and not just any wine, he turned it into good wine. All right, this, which completely throws out the theory that a lot of people have that Jesus never drank, that he was sipping on grape juice. Nobody tastes grape juice and says, this is high quality stuff. You know, no one's at a wedding like, man, usually people put out the good Welch's in the beginning, and then when people are good and drunk, then they put out the crappy stuff. They put out the name brand generic stuff, you know, like, but you saved the Welch's for the last, you know, like this is weird. It completely throws the story on its head. It's wine. It's very clearly wine. And he does this because he is inadvertently drawing a comparison to himself of Jesus and wine, which is kind of weird. And that's why we have this Venn diagram, which those of you guys who are still in school would be familiar with. Venn diagram, so that the things that go in the center are the things that are alike, and the things that go in each circle are the things that are different. So we're going to be using that tonight to talk about the differences and similarities between Christ, and Caleb is going to be writing for us because I guess you guys think I have terrible handwriting. Before we get into this, though, I just have to give one little caveat. The Bible never says anything negative about wine in and of itself. Wine in and of itself is never looked at as a negative thing. In fact, the majority of places that the Bible talks about wine, it actually looks at it in a positive sense. Jesus looked at it in a positive sense. In fact, in the Last Supper, where he drinks wine at the Seder meal with his disciples, he says, I will not drink of the fruit of the vine until I drink it anew with you in the kingdom. So guess what? Wine's going to be in heaven as well. So wine is never looked at as a negative kind of thing. It's the attitude towards wine that is looked at as a negative. And I actually have a verse for us that illustrates this. This is in the book of Proverbs. And I believe it was chapter 23, right, Tom? Chapter 23, 31. Do not look on the wine when it is red, when it sparkles in the cup, when it swirls around smoothly. At the last it bites like a serpent, and it stings like a viper. Your eyes will see strange things, and your heart will utter perverse things. Yes, you will be like one who lies down in the midst of the sea, or like one who lies at the top of the mast, saying, "They have struck me, but I was not hurt. They have beaten me, but I did not feel it. When shall I awake that I may seek another drink?" That's 35. Okay, so as we can see here, and there's actually quite a few Proverbs that are like that. Solomon is saying that it's the attitude towards the wine. It's getting drunk off the wine. It's the lust. It's the greediness. It's the covetousness after wine, the consistent need for wine. That is the negative thing. Wine in itself is not bad. Wine in itself is not bad. And so that's important for us to know as Christians. The Bible never says that wine is bad. It just says that the abuse of wine is bad. The abuse of wine is bad. And that's what makes wine a little bit different than, let's say, drugs. The Bible never says anything positive about drugs. When I say drugs, I'm talking about hallucinogens, things like that, things that would get you high or inebriated. It never says anything positive about those. It actually does say positive things about wine, because you could actually drink wine and not get drunk. So that's just a little thing before we get into it. Now, you don't have to pay attention to all that. But it is important also to know that some people just have that heart towards wine, so they can't touch it at all. Some people are able to touch a little bit of wine and be okay. Some people have a certain propensity towards getting drunk, and so they just can't touch any amount of wine. That's just not something that they are able to do. They don't have the freedom or the liberty to do that. If they touch it, they will abuse it. They don't know how to use it properly. So it's kind of an important thing for us to understand. Me personally, I hate wine. I think it tastes gross. But more power to you if you like it, I guess. I think it tastes disgusting, personally. Anyway, so let's get into the comparisons and contrasting of wine versus Jesus. So here's what he's trying to do. He's using wine as an analogy for the world. He's using wine as an analogy for the world and the pleasures of the world, and he's comparing himself to it. He's saying, I'm like the world in these ways, but I'm different in other ways. I'm going to give you guys three examples. Caleb, if you want to come up here and write these down. Three ways that Jesus is, there's probably more, but these are the ones I thought of. Three ways that Jesus is like wine. And remember, wine is symbolizing the pleasures of this world. All right, so the first way that they're similar is that they are intoxicating. Second way is that they are both addictive over time. And the third way is that they both demand a radical devotion. And notice that the man gives, the master of ceremonies actually gives the major difference. And we're going to talk about them, what that looks like specifically as it applies to each one of these three. But he gives the difference specifically about Jesus in the world right there. He says, some people set out good wine in the beginning, and then when the guests have well drunk, then the inferior. What's he saying? When people go to a wedding and people are first starting to drink, you're going to set out the good wine because they're going to be able to taste that. After a while of drinking, people don't really care what kind of wine they have. You can put out anything at that point. You can put out the Keystone Light or the PBR. No one cares at some point. What he's saying, here's how Jesus is different. He's saying most people put out the best first, and then as time goes on, it gets worse. You get better over time. So that's the major distinction between wine and Jesus, and we're going to see how it plays out in each particular way. The first one, it intoxicates us. It intoxicates us. Think a little bit about the idea of getting drunk. All right, getting drunk is fun. People wouldn't do it if it wasn't fun. It'd be really odd if everyone was spending, and alcohol is expensive, unless, once again, you go with the Keystone Light or something, or Steel Reserve. Alcohol can get very, very expensive. My buddies in the Marine Corps, they spent hundreds of dollars every week on just alcohol. They would spend hundreds and hundreds of dollars on alcohol alone. And these aren't guys who are normally going out to the bars. These are guys who are just sitting in their barracks room and buying alcohol in bulk and sitting alone and drinking themselves into a stupor. Alcohol, in a way, it intoxicates. It makes you feel good. It makes you feel good. And that's what people use it for. And because of that, not only does it feel good, but because of the intoxication factor of it, it can distract you from things. So for instance, why do most people get drunk? I mean, some people get drunk to have a good time, but a lot of people get drunk to forget their problems, right? They're depressed, they're lonely, they're sad, things of that nature. And so they use alcohol in order to escape their problems. They use it to intoxicate themselves so they could forget about reality for a second and just live in a world that's not their life. That's what people use alcohol for. And once again, alcohol is a metaphor for all sins of the world. That's why people use any sin of the world. That's why we use substance abuse. That's why we use pornography. That's why we use sexual abuse. That's why we use relationships. All the idolatry that you can think of in your average day-to-day life, that's why you use it. You use it to escape reality, to intoxicate yourself, make yourself feel better. Now, here's what's wrong with that. First of all, the intoxication of wine is temporary, and like I said, it gets worse over time. Okay, the first time you get drunk, it might feel amazing, and it doesn't take a whole lot to get you drunk. But over time, it takes a whole lot more to get you drunk, and the feeling isn't as good. The high begins to lower more and more. And in fact, a lot of people get drunk, they're just chasing that first high. They're chasing the original feeling that they got when they first got drunk, and they can never quite find it. It is a hype that can never live up to in itself. Okay, so the intoxication factor gets worse over time. And in fact, in the moment, the intoxication factor gets bad over time. I don't know, how many of you guys have seen somebody get really drunk about 4 or 5 hours into it? You guys ever seen anyone like that? How are they doing about 4 or 5 hours into being drunk? Is it still fun? Usually that's when people get really emotional. Usually it's when people start vomiting, getting sick, things like that. Because here's the deal. Imagine your brain is like a bucket of water. Okay, and the bucket of water represents these chemicals that are inside of your brain at all times. You have feel-good chemicals inside of your brain. You have things like dopamine, serotonin, things that make you feel good, things that enable you to deal with depression and loneliness and all these other things. When you get drunk, what happens is you remove the bottom of that bucket and all of that pleasure chemicals just pour out. So it gives you a spike. You feel really good for a really short amount of time. But here's the problem. Your brain is used to naturally re-stimulating itself and reproducing those chemicals. If you just dump all the chemicals out at one time, it's going to take a while to replenish itself. Does that make sense? That's why a lot of people, they drink to forget about their problems. A lot of people commit suicide when they're drunk. A lot of the suicides that we have in America are from people who got drunk and then committed suicide. Why? Because when they were sober, no matter how bad their life may have seemed, they had chemicals in their brain that enabled them to deal with the pain. When they got drunk, all those feel-good chemicals went out the window and they had no way to cope with the depression that was still there. All right, and so they ended up committing suicide. And actually, when you get drunk, I think it takes about 2 to 3 days to replenish those chemicals for your brain to finally fill itself back up. So if you drink every single day, you'll never fill them back up. You'll never feel normal. That's why people get addicted, and we'll talk about that in a little bit. That's why people get addicted to alcohol. They're always chasing that feeling because they can't live without it. They can't live without being drunk, which is really, really sad when it comes to that point. Let me read to you guys a couple quotes that kind of illustrate this a little better. Okay, I got one from Leo Tolstoy. Tolstoy, he was a Russian author, which means that he was very cheerful. That's not true. Very depressing guy. And he actually wrote, at the end of his life, he wrote something about his depression. And I'm just going to read it to you guys. This is him speaking. He said, all this took place at a time when, so far as all my outer circumstances went, I ought to have been completely happy. I had a good wife who loved me and whom I loved, good children, large property, which was increasing with no pains taken on my part. I was more respected by my kinsfolk and acquaintance than I had ever been. I was loaded with praise by strangers, and without exaggeration, I could believe my name was already famous. Moreover, I was neither insane nor ill. On the contrary, I possessed a physical and mental strength which I have rarely met in persons of my age. I could mow as well as a peasant. I could work with my brain 8 hours uninterrupted and feel no bad effects. So here Tolstoy is at the end of his life, and he's saying, I have no idea why I'm depressed. Do you guys catch that? I have no idea why I'm depressed. from an outer perspective, I should be the happiest guy on the planet. I got a great marriage. I got awesome kids. I got tons of money. I have, everybody respects me. I got adoration. I got affirmation. I have everything that anyone could look at and say, that is success. For sure, that's success. And here's what he says. And yet, I could give no reasonable meaning to any actions of my life. And I was surprised that I had not understood this from the very beginning. My state of mind was as if some wicked and stupid jest was being played upon me by someone. One can only live so long as one is intoxicated, drunk with life. But when one grows sober, one cannot fail to see that it is all a stupid cheat. What is truest about it is that there is nothing even funny or silly in it. It is cruel and stupid, pure and simple. Pretty cheery quote, right? Here's what he's saying. He's saying that he was life, the pleasures of this world, the sins of this world, were intoxicating him. They were helping him forget his problems. But after a while, just like alcohol, after a while, you build up a tolerance, is what he's saying. After a while, you build up a tolerance. And then when you get to the end of your life, he says you sober up and you're faced with reality. You're faced with reality. All the problems that you had are now in the front of your brain, and there's nothing you can do to intoxicate yourself and forget about your problems. They're still there. And the only place you can go is into crushing depression. It's the only place you can go. Now, he goes even deeper than that. Notice what he was talking about. He's not just talking about the things that he was choosing to forget by intoxicating himself on life, but he gets to the issue that's really most important. He could not think of any reason for any meaning in his life. Did you catch that? He was an atheist. So he gets to the end of his life and he realizes, why should I go to work? Be like, well, to get money. Why should I get money? To pay your bills. Why should I pay bills? To serve your government. Why should I do that? Because, you know, eventually you get to a why question that you just can't answer. Like, why do anything? Here's what he says at the end of this. This is how he explains it. He says, is there in life any purpose which the inevitable death which awaits me does not undo and destroy? Here's what he's saying. There's nothing I could do in my life that is not going to be undone by my death. So why keep doing anything? You see, life was intoxicating him for a certain amount of times where he could ignore this truth. And by the way, if you guys have any friends who are atheists, who don't know God, and you wonder, like, how could they just live their lives and not be faced with the truth? You know what Tolstoy would say to them? They're being intoxicated by life. They're too drunk with life to realize the issues that are bothering them. You know why you and I don't really spend a lot of our day thinking about God? It's because we're intoxicated with life. We're drunk on it. We're not paying attention to the things that should really matter in our souls. Eternity. You know what's funny though? If you go and you talk to people who are old, who are facing death in the face, they can't ignore eternity anymore. They can't ignore eternity anymore. The high has worn off. The drunk is gone. They are sober. And that's what leads people either into crushing depression or into wonderful hope. And we'll talk about that in a little bit. Here's another quote. I like this one slightly better. This is from a woman named Cynthia Heimel. She used to write a column for a newspaper in Los Angeles. And so because of that, she got to know a lot of celebrities. And I like this because it's very witty and also very cutting. Speaking of celebrities, she says this, I pity them. No, I do. The minute a person becomes a celebrity is the same minute he or she becomes a monster. Sylvester Stallone, Bruce Willis, Barbara Streisand were all once perfectly pleasant human beings with whom you might want to have lunch with on a slow afternoon. But now they've become supreme beings and their wrath is awful. It's not that they what they had in mind. When God wants to play a rotten practical joke on you, he grants you your deepest wish and then giggles merrily when you suddenly realize you want to kill yourself. Isn't that awesome? All right, she keeps going though. Syl, Bruce, and Barbara, fervently, more than any of us, wanted fame. They worked, they pushed, they stepped on the other guy's face in their desperate need. Then finally, one night, each of them became famous and they had a shriek of relief. Now they were adored, invincible, magic. The morning after that night, though, they wanted to take an overdose and die. She keeps going. All their fantasies had been realized, yet the reality was still the same. If they were miserable before, they were twice as miserable now because the giant thing they were striving for, that fame thing that was going to make everything okay, that was going to make their lives bearable, that was going to provide them with personal fulfillment and happiness, had happened and nothing had changed. They were still them. The disillusionment turned them howling and insufferable. Here's what she's saying. Not only does old age do this to you, but achieving your goals will do this to you. Meaning if I'm distracting myself from the real issues of the world, if I'm distracting myself from God with, let's say, a job or school or athleticism or musical ability or drugs or alcohol or anything like that, the moment I achieve what I was striving after is the moment I sober up and I recognize the fact that nothing has changed. I'm still miserable and depressed. See, as long as the carrot is dangling on the stick, you can delude yourself into thinking, the reason why I'm not happy is because I don't have this thing. Does that make sense? The reason why I'm so depressed and unhappy is because I'm not rich enough, or I'm not pretty enough, or I'm not this, or I'm not that. But the second you achieve the thing that you were going after is the second you become miserable. And this woman actually names names. She names celebrities that she was talking to and had conversations with and a relationship with. And she saw that these people were morbidly depressed. Let's listen to some more celebrity quotes. This is from Jim Carrey. He says much the same thing. I think that everybody should get rich and famous and do everything they ever dreamed of so that they can see that it's not the answer. This is Jim Morrison, lead singer of The Doors, died of a heroin overdose. People fear death even more than pain. It's strange that they fear death. Life hurts a lot more than death. At the point of death, the pain is over. Yeah, I guess I'm its friend. Does that sound very cheery? Does that sound like a life that you want to emulate? What happened? He wanted money, he wanted fame, he wanted all these things, and the second he got them, he realized, it doesn't solve anything, I'm still miserable, I'm still depressed, maybe death is the only adventure, as Hook would say. Right? Now let's listen to Robin Williams. He died, he committed suicide, I think last year, maybe the year before. Let's listen to some of his quotes. I used to think that the worst thing in life was to end up alone. It's not. The worst thing in life is to end up with the people who make you feel alone. It's pretty sad. Winning an Oscar is an honor, but between you and me, it doesn't make anything easier. Okay, here's another one. I think the saddest people always try the hardest to make people happy because they want what it, they know what it's like to feel absolutely worthless, and they don't want anyone else to feel like that. So here we kind of actually get a hint into why Robin Williams was a comedic actor. Why become a comedian? Why do this? He actually gives the answer. He says, because I'm very miserable and I don't want other people to feel that way. I want actually to make somebody feel happy. There's that one story of the great clown Pavarotti. I don't know if you guys have heard that. And this guy, he goes into a therapist and he tells him, like, can you please help me? I'm massively depressed. Nothing in life feels good anymore. Everything, all pleasures seem to go away. I don't know if I could even go one more day. And the guy says, hey, man, I got the perfect solution for you. There's a clown. It's amazing. No way you can go to a show and not laugh. The dude is incredible. You know, he's hysterical. His name is Pavarotti. Just go to his concert, go to his show, and it's going to pick up your spirits, you're going to feel great, it's going to totally take away your pain, and you're going to feel the need to live. And the man turns to the therapist and he says, there's only one problem, I am the great clown, Pavarotti. So what's the point? The point is that here's this guy trying to make all these people happy, but the reason why he's trying to make all people happy is why? Because he has a hole in his heart that he's trying to fill with something else. He's trying to intoxicate himself with something, and it's not working anymore. One last quote. The tragedy of life is not death, but what dies inside of us while we still live. Okay, so I can either look at life and I can say, you know, I want to become intoxicated with life. You know, and see how that gets me. See where it gets me. But I think I already know the answer. And honestly, these people who wrote these things, they could have saved themselves the trouble and just read the book of Ecclesiastes. It was written 3,000 years before they were even born. And they would have completely saved themselves all the trouble of figuring this out for themselves. Things don't satisfy. Pleasures don't work. It doesn't fill the hole. Relationships only satisfy for a time. These things only distract from the real issue. You need Christ in your heart. Ecclesiastes 3, verse 10. God has put eternity in your hearts. There's always going to be something in you that's like, man, this just doesn't feel right. I don't feel good. I don't feel satisfied. And that hole just keeps getting bigger and bigger and bigger the longer you live and the longer you try to stuff it with things that just don't satisfy. And eventually you're going to sober up, and eventually it's going to lead to your feeling of meaninglessness. Okay? Or you can go with Jesus. Now here's how Jesus is different. Jesus gets better over time. Jesus gets better over time. Here's how he does that. When I'm intoxicated with wine, like I said, it fades, and the higher the high, the lower the low. And the more it distracts from the real issues of life, the more pain is going to come when they finally confront me at the end of my life or when I finally sober up. Here's the beautiful thing about Jesus. Jesus gets better over time, not only because a relationship with him always gets better and better, and there is no come down from hanging out with Jesus. I don't think I've ever gone into a time of real devotion or intimacy with Christ and gone away from it feeling like, man, I'm such a scumbag, and woke up the next day with a headache and needed to drink a lot of water and light hurt my eyes. Nothing like that has ever happened to me. The closer and more near I get to Christ, the more I desire and yearn for him, and the more pleasurable he becomes over time. There is no lows with Christ. There is no lows that Christ himself produces, should I say. Lows will happen in your life, but like I said, Jesus remains more and more pleasurable the closer you get to heaven, the closer you get to home. Here's another thing that he does. Jesus does not distract from the real issues of life. Jesus perfects the real issues of life. So wine, alcohol, the sins of your life, they distract you from eternity. Jesus puts eternity right in front of your face and he says, I've already solved the problem. You're going to spend eternity with me. I've already solved your need for meaning and value and identity. It's all found in me. You could be complete in me. See, Jesus doesn't distract us from the issues. Jesus confronts us with the issues and he makes us whole. And that's something that the world can never do. The world can't make you whole. It can only distract. Jesus can actually fix what's broken. So if I'm walking through my life and I have depression, anxiety, fears, worthlessness, inadequacies, all these other things that would drive me to the world, to sin, to sexual pleasures, to alcoholism, to drug abuse, to overeating, to all these other things that I've tried to fill the hole with, and instead of doing that, instead of distracting from the issue, I could turn to Jesus and have those things healed. Now, it is a process to have those things healed in Christ. It doesn't happen overnight. I'm still in the process. For most of my life, especially when I was 13 to 16, when I was actually an atheist, I tried to use the world to satisfy what was broken in me. And it did not work. It did not work. I came face to face with exactly what these people were saying. And it's very sad because at the age of 16, I realized that was true. I gave up God for sexual pleasure. And after just 3 short years of living for sexual pleasure, I realized that this thing is not all it's cracked up to be. It's pretty meaningless in the end. And it was only when I came to Christ and have a relationship with Christ now that I'm starting to see him heal those broken parts of me. Now, the next thing that it is addictive over time. This is going to be a little shorter. Oh, wait. I have one more thing to add to the intoxication thing that I just said. There's a man named Horatio Spafford. He lived back about 100 years ago. His family was actually pretty wealthy. They lived in Chicago. He had a couple kids. And at one season of his life, his son died. And so the family was in intense mourning. They were very sad. And so they were planning a vacation to Europe to get their minds off the mourning, the sadness. And all of a sudden, the Chicago fire happened, and all of his money was burned up, literally. He had invested heavily in real estate, so he lost all of his wealth in basically one night. So honestly thinking, like, yeah, we definitely need a vacation now, he sends his family over, but he remains to help deal with the financial fallout of what had just happened. The boat that was carrying his wife and 3 kids sank. All 3 of his kids died. And his wife barely made it to safety. Now, as Horatio Spafford was crossing the Atlantic to go over to Europe, he crossed the part of the ocean that they told him that the ship went down. And when he was crossing that part of the ocean, he wrote very famous words. He said this, "When peace like a river attendeth my way, when sorrows like sea billows roll, whatever my lot, you have taught me to say, it is well, it is well, it is well with my soul." So if you've ever heard that song, "It Is Well With My Soul," understand when it was written. It was written not when someone was like on the high horse, winning the lotto, with everything they could ever want. It was when someone had literally lost everything. And in his losses, he discovered, all I really have is Christ. All I really have is Christ. And he was able to make it through. This was not a man who was intoxicated with the world. This was a man who was intoxicated with Christ. He found his pleasure, satisfaction, and value in Jesus alone. And notice what it allowed him to do. It allowed him to overcome incredible difficulties and still find pleasure and joy inside of Jesus. So that's what we can have when we find intoxication inside of Christ alone. Jesus is pleasurable. We should seek him in that way. Next thing, it's addictive over time. If you drink a glass of wine, it's not going to make you addictive. You know, you got to drink it quite often and quite a bit in order to get addicted to it. In fact, wine is, as I'm told by people who actually like it, it is an acquired taste. All right, so the first time you drink it, you're not supposed to like it. It gets better over time the more you drink it, and then it gets more. No, Tom shaking his head. Apparently not. Apparently it just sucks, but you just pretend like it's good, you know, maybe to impress your rich friends. Over time of drinking alcohol, it gets more and more addictive. But here's why it gets addictive. Wine gets addictive. Alcohol is addictive because it gets worse over time. That's why it's addictive. Okay, like I said, people who get addicted to wine get addicted to alcohol. They get addicted because they're always chasing the previous high that they had, or they're always trying to intoxicate themselves. They're always trying to get over their problems. And it's only when you use it so often that you suddenly realize, I can't stop even if I wanted to. I can't stop even if I wanted to. Here's how Jesus is better. Okay. And by the way, I'm just going to bring this up because I think it's important, especially for people of our age. Love can be this way too. But there's a very big difference between God's love and this world's love, which we call lust. Okay. This world's love could look very much like God's love. But I'll say this as well. This world's love, this lust, is just like alcohol. It's intoxicating. It's addictive, makes you feel great, but you'll see it slowly and slowly get worse and worse over time until it has you, and you can't escape. You can't escape it. Okay? It's a very sad moment when people realize that as much as I would like to quit alcohol, I don't have the strength. I don't have the ability. My body is so dependent. In fact, alcohol is one of these weird things where actually if you're a major alcoholic, they'll tell you, don't stop drinking. And you got to wean your way off because your body is so addicted to that thing that if you stop drinking cold turkey, you'll die. You know, so it's one of these scary things that your body becomes so dependent on that you need to wean your way off. All right, so alcohol is addictive because it gets worse and it puts you in chains. Jesus is better because he gets better over time. Jesus is also an acquired taste. The first time you taste of Jesus, it's not going to be like, man, that's like way better than drugs. It's not going to happen. Over time of trying Jesus, of tasting Jesus, of seeing Jesus, of spending time with Jesus, of relating to Jesus, of falling in love with Jesus, he's going to get better and better and better and better and better over time. And you keep going back because every single time you go back, he's even better than the last time. That's how Jesus is different. And that's, by the way, how the love of God is different. The love of God gets better over time. If you ever look at people, and, you know, especially since I'm a newlywed, I get this all the time, people who say to me, like, oh, I remember when I was a newlywed. Now, what the underlying implication of that sentence is, just wait. It gets worse. You know, like, that's the other, like, whenever I'm like, man, Emma's so awesome, she's beautiful, she's amazing, just wait. She won't be. You know, like, that's kind of the implication when people say that. Now, here's why they say that, is because they only know this world's version of love. Of course it's going to get worse over time. It's intoxicating, it's addictive, but it gets worse over time. It gets less and less satisfactory over time, but people just don't know how to get out of it because it's all they know. They're addicted to it. Can't leave it. They're in a crappy relationship that they want nothing to do, but they just don't know how to leave it because they're addicted to it. And here's the beautiful thing about God's love. If you're really abiding in God's love, meaning I'm now tapping into a love that's greater than myself, it will get better and better and better each and every day that I partake of Christ. So the more I find intimacy with Jesus, the greater and more passionate and more beautiful the love that I have should get. which is really awesome. And that's the kind of love that we actually want inside of our lives. We don't want the love that just like, you know, you have it and then it sucks over time. You know, or are you just like, you know, I talked to my buddy, Chris, from he went to my wedding. He was in the Marines with me. Me and him, actually, I started dating Emma around the same time that he was dating this other girl. And he was just like, man, I love her. She's awesome. She's amazing. We just love each other so much. And we were talking about how awesome relationships are. I met him again. I met up with again right when I got engaged to Emma. And I was like, hey, man, you're invited to my wedding. He's like, okay, yeah, sure. I was like, you still with that girl? He's like, nah. I was like, what happened? He's like, well, we realized after a time that the only reason why we were together is because of the sex. And then she had to move out. So like they got to a point in their relationship where it got so bad that the only thing keeping them together was the sex, was the little high that they got when they had intimacy. That was it. That was the only thing that kept them together. And the fact that they would have had to, you know, well, she's already living with me, so, you know, it kind of sucked to make her go out and get another apartment. That would be a real hassle. You know, so like the hassle and the sex was the only thing that was keeping those two together. They were just... they weren't in love. They were infatuated with one another, and the destruction of that relationship is still affecting both of them. You see, that's how it's similar to this. God's love is different. God's love is different. It gets better over time. It gets better over time. Now we're going to move into the third and final one. Both of them demand radical devotion. Okay, so let's keep going in this passage. Verse 13. Now the Passover of the Jews was at hand, and Jesus went up to Jerusalem, and he found in the temple those who sold oxen and sheep and doves and the money changers doing business. So Jesus does this twice in his ministry. A lot of us are familiar with the time that he does it at the end of his ministry, but he actually did it at the beginning of his ministry as well. And what he did is he went to the temple, and in the outer court, which was where the Gentiles were, they were taking advantage of people. They were making money. They were making a profit off of people by changing their money. Like they would say, oh, man, you got Roman currency? Dude, we only take holy currency here. You know, so you give me your dollar bills and I'll give you gold coins. And that's what you give to God. But they would take some interest off the top. Or they would be selling animals. They'd be like, hey, man, you want to make a sacrifice that's going to make God really happy? This is a Rabbi Hillel approved, you know, kosher beef. It's going to be awesome. The Lord's going to love it. You know, if you want to bring your cow, you know, your little three-leg cow, you know, that you can. But, you know, if you really want to, if you really love the Lord, man, you'll get this cow, you know. And it's like $2,000. So that's what they were doing. And Jesus, he walks in and he sees this. He sees the temple, this place that he created to be a place where his people could gather together to worship him and glorify him and honor him. And all he sees people doing is honoring themselves, glorifying themselves, serving themselves. And he becomes angry. He becomes very angry. Look what he does. I like the story. When he made a whip of cords, he drove them all out of the temple with the sheep and the oxen, poured out the changers of the money, and overturned the tables. I love that. You know, because like so often, you know, we hear Jesus meek and mild walking through a daisy field, little lammy over his shoulder. I like to see stories of Jesus where he's a man, you know, where he's just like, man, he's flipping tables and he's whipping people and he's throwing people out of there. I like that. I'm like, man, dude, that's awesome. And he says this in verse 16. And he said to those who sold doves, take these things away. Do not make my father's house a house of merchandise. Then his disciples remembered what is written, zeal for your house has eaten me up. So the Jews answered and said to him, what sign do you show us since you do these things? Jesus answered and said to them, destroy this temple, and 3 days I will raise it up. Then the Jews says, it has taken 46 years to build this temple, and you will raise it up in 3 days? But he was speaking of the temple of his body. Therefore, when he had risen from the dead, his disciples remembered what he had said to this to them, and they believed the scripture and the word which Jesus had said. Now, when he was in Jerusalem at the Passover during the feast, many believed in his name when they saw the signs which he did. But Jesus did not commit himself to them because he knew all men and had no need that anyone should testify of a man, for he knew what was in man. Now, this is a very important story. Like I said, both alcohol and Jesus require radical devotion to themselves. It's kind of a weird way to think about it. Alcohol demands radical devotion. It demands a lot from you. If you want to be an alcoholic, if you wake up and you're like, man, I really just want to, I aspire to be an alcoholic, you got to give up a lot. You got to give up a lot of things. You're going to have to give up your health. You're going to have to give up tons of money. You're going to have to give up tons of time. You're going to have to give up security. A lot of your family is probably going to be wrecked by it. You know, and eventually you're going to have to give up your life. that thing's going to rot away your liver and it's going to kill you. He said to be an alcoholic demands radical devotion to alcohol. It demands radical devotion to that thing. Jesus demands radical devotion to him. Notice what he's doing. He's going into the temple and he's overturning these tables. Now, you might ask the question of like, well, how does this apply to us? It applies to us in two ways. First of all, notice what he's angry about. He's angry that people are coming to a place that God created where his people could come together and worship and glorify him, and instead he sees people worshiping and glorifying themselves. Now, I don't think I have to elaborate too much into this, but look at what the Church of America looks like. How many people go to church to worship and glorify God, and how many people go to church to do one of these things? Either A, to assuage their guilt, meaning they're like, man, I had a pretty crappy week. I did a lot of bad stuff. Well, I could always go to church, and then all is forgiven. You know, I'll just do my penance, and then I'm good. You know, or they go to church because they're like, you know, I like the worship. You know, it makes me feel good. I like the pastor, man. He just makes me laugh. Dude, it's so funny. It's awesome. What are they thinking about? Are they thinking about glorifying God? Thinking about glorifying who? Me. How many of the churches, they go to church because, man, if you come here and you worship in this way and you do these things and you give to us, God's going to bless you, man. He's going to give you tons of money and cash and things, and it's going to be amazing. Once again, why are they going to church? Is it because God, or is it because of what? Me. That's the first way it applies to us. Here's the second way it applies to us. Did you know that your body is now the temple of God? 1 Corinthians 6. I have that one up there. 1 Corinthians 6, verse 18. Flee sexual immorality. Every sin that a man does is outside the body, but he who commits sexual immorality sins against his own body. Or do you not know that your body is the temple of the Holy Spirit, who is in you, whom you have from God, and you are not your own? For you were bought at a price. Therefore, glorify God in your body and in your spirit, which are God's. Here's what Paul's saying. You're the temple now. And if Jesus was this zealous over a couple bricks, how much more zealous is he going to be over you? You know the song, He's Jealous for Me? He's jealous for me. Now, a lot of us, we sing that and we're like, oh, Jesus is jealous for me, man. He just loves me. He does. He does. But that jealous love that would not even allow Hades and death to win is jealous for you. He wants you just for himself. Think about that. He wants to be in exclusive relationship with you. He doesn't want anything polluting your relationship with him. And if you have things in your life that are intoxicating you, that are addicting you, that are dragging you away and demanding devotion that isn't him, he's going to deal with it. He's going to deal with it because he demands that radical type of devotion to himself. He demands it for himself. And so if we have these things inside of our life, you can bet your life that God is going to deal with you one way or the other. One way or the other. One of the ways that he deals with you is he gives you exactly what you want and you realize just how empty it is and you come back to him. Another way that he deals with you is he takes away everything that you want to show you that only he is worthy. You don't want either one to happen to you. You can either ask God to clean your temple and he'll do it gently, or you can wait and he'll come in and do it by force. I would recommend that you ask him and allow him to do it gently. Because if you wait, it's going to wreck you. It's going to destroy you. I have so many people in the Tuesday group who waited and their life is done. Their marriage is over. You know, their family is broken. Their job, they're fired, they've lost everything, and now they're finally coming back to God. It's like, dude, why did you wait? Why did you wait until this point? Why didn't you come to God when it was easy and asked him to cleanse you? Now, here's the final thing. Like I said, both of them demand radical devotion, but remember, alcohol demands radical devotion in a different way than Jesus demands radical devotion. Alcohol demands radical devotion out of slavery. Okay, you're addicted to it. You can't stop. When I go to the Salvation Army and I talk to the guys who are addicted to alcohol, none of them are sitting around saying like, oh man, I love alcohol, man. It's the best thing for me. Dude, it makes me healthier and happier and funner, and it's helping my life in so many different ways. The reason why they're still drinking alcohol is because they don't have a choice. They would give anything to stop, but they can't. They don't have the ability to stop. They're slaves. They've given into their sins so much that they can't break it off even if they wanted to. They're slaves. Sin leads you through slavery. Sin demands devotion from you through slavery. You don't have a choice and you can't leave even if you want to. Jesus demands devotion from you out of love. Listen to this passage. This is Hosea chapter 11. Hosea chapter 11, God is speaking to his people. And Hosea is a beautiful book that illustrates God's love for his people as a husband's love for his wife, even when the wife is completely unfaithful to him. Israel says, Hosea chapter 11, verse 3. I taught Ephraim to walk, taking them by the arms, but they did not know that I had healed them. I drew them with gentle cords, with bands of love, and I was to them as those who take the yoke from their neck. I stooped and fed them. Jesus, you can leave him whenever you want. He demands devotion from you, but it is out of love. Think of the story of the prodigal son. When the prodigal son said, hey, Dad, I think I want to leave. What did the dad say? Go for it. Jesus doesn't hold you by slavery. You can leave him whenever you want. You could deny him. You could yell at him. You could scream at him. You could curse him. You could deny him. You could do whatever you want because he loves you. He doesn't force you into anything. If you want to go against God's will in your life, he will allow you to do that. God leads you through love. He wants you. Notice what he says. I love the imagery. He says, I drew you with gentle bands. With love is how I drew you. There's no compulsion with Christ. There's no, I need to, I have to. If I don't, I go to hell. This is terrible. That's not why. It's because Jesus, you taste and you see that genuinely, Jesus' plans and his ways are way better than everything that I thought was going to work out for me. Everything that I thought, like, man, that's going to work out for me, ended up enslaving me and hurting me and destroying my life. But everything that Jesus has asked me to do has given me greater pleasure, joy, intimacy, strength, courage, hope, everything that I could ever want and desire, Jesus has given me. And so because of that, I start to trust him and love him and serve him simply out of love. 2 Corinthians 5, the love of Christ constrains us. That's the difference between a Christian and someone who's in the world. We're free. We're free to do whatever we want, but we don't want to sin anymore because Jesus is better. He's more pleasurable than our sin. I'm going to end with this. This is a hymn written by John Newton. This is what he says. How long beneath the law I lay in bondage and distress. I toiled the precept to obey, but toiled without success. Then to abstain from outward sin was more than I can do. Now if I feel its power within, I feel I hate it too. Then all my servile works were done, a righteousness to raise. Now freely chosen in the Son, I freely choose his ways. Our pleasure and our duty, though opposites before, since we have seen his beauty, are joined to part no more. To see the law by Christ fulfilled and hear his pardoning voice transforms a slave into a child and duty into choice. All right, let's pray. Dear God, I want to thank you so much for your word, that you love us so much and you care for us so much, Lord. Thank you that we know that we can always come to you, Lord. Your arms are always open to us. Please help us and encourage us. Help us to drink of you. Help us to find our satisfaction, our everything in you. Please heal us. Please help us to deny the worldly things, God, and to go after you alone. We love you so much. In your name, amen.